So this is the Looking Glass podcast, where we speak with people who worked for Looking Glass, which made some influential games, games like System Shock and Thief. And we're here today with Dan Thrawn.
Hello.
Hello.
That's correct.
Hello, Dan. Dan is joining us over Skype. So we have this setup here to make this work. And also joining us is Terry Brocious.
Brocious, yeah.
Brocious.
Yeah. Okay. Hi.
And she is with us here at Gambit. So this is I was hoping this would work. It's a complicated media setup, and hopefully there will be no horrible problems. So I usually the way we start this is we ask people about how they got into the company, and okay. Then we kind of go through the different projects they worked on. And I will say that I will mention at the beginning, it's fine, we can talk about any projects. I'm actually quite interested in all the different projects or whatever you remember. But I will say that the reason I wanted to do the two of you together is because you were both recommended to me by Randy Smith.
Dan, do you want to start with how you got into Looking Glass?
I lied. I lied so bad. Yeah, I told them that I could use Photoshop, and I didn't know anything about it. I never used it before. And then I was a traditional, like a pen and ink illustrator, and I was really, really desperate for work. And a friend of mine, Glenn Weldon, hooked me up with an interview there with, I think, Dan Schmidt and Tim Stelmach. And they didn't know what questions to ask because they didn't know anything about the program that they were asking about because they didn't have anybody that did it.
Lucky.
And I didn't know anything about how to answer them, so I think that it all worked out well in the end.
what year would this have been?
It was 95.
Around 95. Do you remember what project you were sort of interviewing for coming in on?
It was British Open Golf.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we just... actually, just talked with Eric about that. He mentioned.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He mentioned that. Yeah. Cool. So you got the job through your mysterious
through lying.
Yeah, conniving. Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
And just really quick. I mean, like, were you employed as an artist before that full time or?
No. I was. I think at the time I was working at like Blockbuster Video. So Terry finds all this out now.
I never knew.
Yeah. No. I think I had just been fired from Blockbuster like 3 weeks previous, and I was splitting an apartment in Boston with like five guys at once, and the choice was, you know, pay your rent or, you know, get beaten up. So I had to find something, and I didn't think I would get the gig at all. I thought that was a total dead end.
Okay. I'm guessing that Terry, you got in by telling the truth.
I told the truth. but you know what, I feel like I'm, of all the gaming people that I know, I'm the most accidental of all the gaming people, because I really slid in like sideways. Because I was really, I'm a musician, but at the time I was employed as an executive assistant at a venture capital firm.
Whoa.
So I was really, you know, actually, you know, earning a lot of money. But then I would get phone calls from Greg LaPiccolo. He'd say, do you want to, like, maybe just, you know, record this weird, evil, you know, computer voice for this game we're doing? And I'd be like, sure, whatever, I'll do that. Sounds like fun. And, you know, I'd go and I'd do that. And then, you know, a couple months later, do you think you might want to write, like, a little bit of, like, dialogue or some story for this other game we're doing, you know? And I'd be like, yeah, I'm totally into that. But meanwhile, I'd be taking these phone calls while I was working at a venture capital firm. And then finally I said to Eric, you know, like, Eric, I think maybe I'll just try and apply to Looking Glass. And he's like, no, you're going to hate it. You don't want to be a designer. You'll hate it. They're the lowest on the totem pole, you know. They're really treated badly. And I'm like, yeah, but I kind of like the work. I think I might want to learn to build levels. And, you know, and he really didn't think I would like it. But But I tried to apply, and but then every time I tried to get into Looking Glass, they wanted me as an executive assistant. That's what I was doing. So it was like this weird thing where they'd go, oh, yeah, sure, you can work here, but, you know, you'll be my secretary. And I'll be like, nope. And then finally, right, Dan? When did I finally, like, join the team as a beginning designer?
That was when it was still Dark Project, right? When it was still
So Thief Gold is the first project that I worked on. Thief had already shipped, and Thief Gold was starting.
Okay.
And that's when they finally hired me as a beginning designer.
Okay.
And that was the first time that I worked full time there. They finally said, "Okay, you can do something." They always wanted me as a secretary. I'm already got the best secretary gig in the world. why would I be a secretary for you?
but you had already done voice acting and writing at that point.
That's right.
And they were like, "Wow, you're great at voice acting and writing, but we want you to be a secretary."
Yeah. Yep. I just didn't buy it, and I wanted to work there so badly. You know, I really loved the Thief game. I wasn't really a gamer, but when I was playing Thief, I'm like, this is the best game ever. I really want to do this all the time. I mean, I loved it. I loved the, you know, I thought I would enjoy building levels too.
Well, that's interesting to me coming from, because I know coming from art. Dan, were you much of a gamer before?
Not really, no. No, actually, I'm a big movie nerd. I continue to be a big movie nerd, but I didn't really know anything about computers or video games or anything when I started there.
That's interesting, because when I talked to Ken, he said the part of the plot of Thief was inspired by Chinatown.
Oh, yeah. Ken and I talked a lot about that.
I mean, to be fair, not Chinatown specifically, but just film noir. He mentioned Chinatown as his example.
Yeah, and I think that Terry and Ken and I talked a lot about Chinatown and Third Man and all that.
Oh, I love The Third Man.
Oh, I love Third Man.
Yeah, that was big.
I think at this point I should mention that I didn't have anything to do with the plot, really, of the Thief games, but I was providing...
That's not true. That's not true. She's actually catching up online right now.
Here's the only influence I could have had. I was a contractor. I would write some stuff. I'd send it over to me, this invisible fence, it over to people who I wasn't really working with, you know, and I'd go, you know, I really didn't have much information, so I wrote the scene like that. Is that okay? And then, you know, I would just hear back from Greg. Yeah, they loved it. That was it.
I want to add to that. I think the direction, like there's such a directional change between like what Thief started as to what Thief became, especially by the time of Thief 2. And so much of that had to do with what Terry was writing, because it was getting weirder and weirder and weirder.
I'm interested in, because when I went and talked to Ken, Ken talked a lot about being there with Doug Church at the beginning and coming up with initial concepts, and he said that he did like research and like submarine combat for like some of the unseen stealth kind of gameplay and stuff. But at some point I know that he left and kind of dropped this sort of, you know, two-thirds complete kind of world into your lap. And my understanding is that the two of you have a significant, effect of in terms of how it turned out from where Ken left off. I don't want to say it was only the two of you, but I...
Well, no, I think it started out with, like, Ken's major influence, like, and I think the biggest influence that anyone I know has had on games is that he wrote this document about, it was the submarine gaming document, and it was, like, that was the start of sneaker gaming, and that's what Thief really represented. And so he was very, if I'm remembering this right, like, he was really interested in that as a game design concept, but artistically, they were still sort of fishing around for how to apply that best. And a few people wanted to do a medieval game, and they wanted to do a Camelot game. And so we originally were going with the Dark Camelot,
which was, that. Yep.
Right. And so there's loads and loads of concept art that really great stuff that Rob Waters did. That was all these really sort of strange takes on all these Camelot.
And you were like ideas. You were Mordred in it, weren't you? It was kind of like, you know, yeah, my dad's a jerk, kind of.
Yeah, you know. exactly. And like I think that because after that, you know, Ken and the Irrational team really started developing, and they went off to do their own thing. But it was when I started working on doing concept art with Mark Lazat, and Terry and I just started bouncing ideas back and forth that it got far away from the Camelot deal and just into this strange steampunk thing that I think that we were really into at the time, and I still think is awesome today.
So I mean that's one of the things that's at least that I've mentioned a few times is that I remember the first time I saw the game. I think it was like the demo. It was before it was even called Thief, because I think even in the original trailer for it, just said the Dark Project. If I remember
the Dark Project
correctly,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Which was actually named that just because that was the heading on our on our corporate schedule.
The
Dark Project.
I've heard that, and then it was like retroactively rationalized in the
right.
writing in a log where. I think the trickster is like, I have a Dark Project, and,
yeah,
which I remember from the game saying, oh, that's how they got the title in.
Right.
But the 2D, I guess like one of the main things that everybody remembers are the 2D cutscenes, right, and the look mm-hmm. and of those, and they almost, to me, have a kind of Ralph Bakshi kind of kind of animation style.
Right.
I mean, which is unusual then, unusual now.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, was that you primarily, or like how did that all?
Yeah, that was me and Josh Randall, because Josh had started using After Effects, and he got really excited about how, what new things you could do with that, and then he introduced me to that, and I started painting stuff, and we started, just grinding together the style. I think, like, initially, it was because we needed to do, we were trying to execute a version of what Ken's concepts for the cutscenes would be, and they were more like, the way he was thinking about them was like a motion comic, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so which was really ahead of its time just by itself, so we tried a bunch of different versions of that, and then eventually we just we dropped the comic book framing of it entirely and just did it as like a cinematic style and just tried to bump it up more into being a movie rather than
you mean kind of like Max Payne or something, like the cutscenes in like the original Max Payne, if you remember that?
Sort of like that, like what's the, you can see some motion comics on the iPad now, and like they're semi-animated frames, and you sort of slide them over, and then the next frame comes in with a little bit of a, like, flash animation to it. Mm. But it was a lot simpler in the original concept, and then Josh and I just got a little overexcited.
Am I wrong? But there's some live action stuff in there too. Like there's like some,
oh, yeah.
but it's all like shadow work or silhouette work, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we shot that in the Looking Glass green screen facility, which was like 5 or 6 feet tall, and about 8 feet wide, and we just like some people like wearing like regular office clothes in front of the green screen doing stuff.
So that's that. Also, that makes me think of the credit screen, which has everybody wearing the cloak.
Yeah.
And was it the same cloak? Did you?
That was the same smelly cloak. Yeah, that was definitely.
I'm sure you had like just maybe one or two.
Right.
So you said that the two of you kind of figured out the world sort of after Ken left. But was that before you started doing those cutscenes? Like, did you have talks? Like, Terry? Did you come in like after the kind of that look was kind of established, or was the look like the result of some of the story stuff you were talking about?
I think that I would, I wasn't there all the time, so I would get sort of, I can't remember if I would come in to talk about what the next cutscene was going to be, Dan, or if I would just like get an email from you and Greg or something,
right.
And then I'd come up with a pass at a script. And then you guys would get, maybe then I would come in sometimes and they would get back to me like, I love this part. You know, I love it when, you know, the trickster says this, or, you know, when Victoria says that or whatever, it's gotta be shorter. It's always that, it was always that, right? It's gotta be shorter. but you know, I just don't, you know, I feel like Dan, you must've done most of the work of completing the world, because I just remember, you know, the moments like, okay, you know, I want this to happen in the cutscene, but this doesn't really create.
So were you very much a dialogue writer for the cutscenes? It was kind of like, this is what happens in the cutscene. Like, you don't get to make up what happens in the cutscene, but they need to talk and we don't know what they're going to say.
A little bit. Or is they go, all we need to do is we need, you know, we're going to end this and Garrett needs to be injured and the keepers are going to rescue him. I'm like, really? That's all you're going to give me?
Exactly.
So whose idea was it to rip out his eye?
I'm going to give that to Terry.
I think that might have been mine.
It was Terry. Well, and I think that, like, that scene in particular, both in, like, when we were developing that, kicking that around, and also in when once, because Terry was also doing the voice of Victoria, and that's the first scene that gets really wacky. Like, it's really, really strange. Yeah. And it's also one of the most successful bits of animation that we ever pulled off. And I remember when we, once we showed our version of what Terry had written, like, it's the, you know, the shot when Victoria throws her hand out and suddenly the vines explode and knock Garrett back into a pillar. And, like, I remember Greg watched this and he just goes, holy shit! he was totally freaked out. And then we watched that a bunch, and I think that was when, like, that's when Terry and I started to get a lot more influence on the way the world was going. But I feel like the style of work at Looking Glass was so sort of, I don't know, it's like a college dorm vibe that was going on, and there was no real focused, you know, person who was leading where things were going. We were all just sort of getting together and talking about stuff all the time. And so you have, like, Mark Lazat doing these awesome, you know, awesome concepts, and Terry and I talking about bizarre story ideas, and Tim Stelmach working in the gameplay, and, you know, all this stuff. And, like, it all just sort of, like, everyone just started agreeing with each other. And I think that it, like, because it became, once it started becoming visual through the movies that Terry and I were making, like, that's what solidified things for everybody else, when actually we're mainly just sort of putting a spin on what everyone was already making up together, you know. So we were just sort of sealing it.
So so do the cutscenes come, I mean, I get the feeling that it probably wasn't this simple, that it was probably like a kind of both, but do the cutscenes primarily come first, or like were like texture artists using that as an inspiration for how they were designing the 3D worlds, or is it more like you were like, well, here's what the first level looks like, so obviously, you know, things like color palette, etc.,
right,
have to match, right, that, or do you not remember it being one or the other?
No, it was definitely like a back and forth, because they had to develop the game, you know, like we had to start the cutscenes and they had to develop the game at the same time, so we ended up, like, you know, Mark Lazat would provide us with, like, the texture sets that he and his crew were doing, and then we'd start to incorporate that into the paintings for the cutscenes, you know, and then he'd see those and base more game art off of that, and, you know, just sort of like this echo chamber effect.
Yeah,
it was a really, really great way to work. That's the way I still prefer to work.
Yeah,
very, 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 you know, democratic and very fun.
Sounds very commie to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it that, like, intentional, that kind of, you know, democratic kind of environment, or?
Well, I think that, Dan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a lot of talking, you know, about how things are supposed to look and sound, and Greg LaPiccolo was also very clear that everything should be a cohesive unit. And so as things developed, I think that everyone was, you know, there weren't any, I like to call them rogue designers, you know, when people go off in their own direction because they think it's funny or they think it's, you know, cool, but it has nothing to do with a really great cohesive game. Yeah. So that I wasn't right there, but I think that for one magical moment, there were no rogue designers. You know, they were, everybody was collaborating and getting on the same page. Does that sound right to you, Dan?
I think that's right in the money. Yeah, I mean, like, I think that, like, it's a, like, everyone definitely brought their own thing to it. You know, and everyone, but like we just had this weird sense of creative agreement all the time. So it doesn't sound totally fantastical. Like part of what we were doing was that the level designers and the folks that were physically building the game, like sometimes I wouldn't get to talk to them or see levels, you know, for weeks, and then we'd be making one of the cutscenes and we'd look at the level and go, oh my god, that's totally different than what we were planning on or what we'd already illustrated. And so we had to bend to that, or they had to change their level designs to fit what we were representing them in the movie. And so it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't perfectly gelled, you know, we weren't like a mass mind, but it was like, I think that it was those kinds of curveballs that made us more, like, more creative in answering these problems. And I think, like, the reason why it worked out so well is that you, even when you do get hit by problems like that, if you have, ego-free people to work with, then nobody gets proprietary and we all try to solve the problem as opposed to freaking out that it's broken. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the real, like, the magic of Looking Glass was like the fact that nobody, you know, was trying to, get in anybody else's way. They were all trying to, like, just make everything, fit together and work. And because of, like, the rogue designer problem is not, like, it's definitely in games all the time, and it's also definitely in movies, like in making movies. Mm-hmm. Like, you get so many people that are involved in these things, and like, you go and check and see what someone's been working on, and it's completely in a different direction. And it's how you and they respond to that that makes things work or makes things fall apart.
Right. That's a good point.
A boring point, but a good point. Dull point, but yeah, very.
Well. One of the things that these podcasts, I feel like I would like them to be some kind of a record as to, you know, if people work at a game company and it's very kind of, you know, creatively broken because people think it has to be a certain way. Right. I think being able to hear something like this, to like hear people talk about, you know, that no, it, you know, at least in this particular circumstance, it did work this way. And I think it's important, you know, I think a lot of times certain kinds of processes continue just because that's all people know, or they think that's the way it has to be. And mm-hmm. every place they've ever worked was like that, or somebody, you know, somebody has a broken process and they're a newbie, and then he's like, does it have to be this way? They're like, yes, you know, and it's like, you know, right. I mean, it doesn't actually have to be that way.
I worked on lots of stuff that I really enjoyed working on. I worked at great companies, and I'm totally psyched with everything that's going on now. But I've never worked with such a group of smart folks in my life. Like, it was insane, the level that everyone was operating on all the time, and I constantly felt super dumb talking to these guys. And I think that it's easy to imagine, like, what that game, like, what Thief or Thief 2 would be like if you had taken any part of that out of it. Like, if Dan Schmidt weren't there, or if me and Terry weren't there, what would be missing from the game? You'd definitely feel it. Like, and I think that everyone respected each other's ideas super strongly. And I think, like, what Terry and I really brought was, like, if we weren't there, I think it would have been a more traditional, medieval, regular fantasy game. Like, it would have been a really clever, well-executed one, and the game design would have been equally as phenomenal. But I think that the sort of David Lynchy vibe that we worked to bring in, I think that's part of what people remember, you know, along with, you know, incredible game design.
It's hard to remember, you know, what my thought process was. You know, when I write, and when I, you know, I especially love working with Dan, because he is so visual. We have, he loves movies. He's seen like all, every single movie ever, but I've seen enough movies that we can still have some conversations. And so we would like find some common ground and start talking. But a lot of times I just felt like, okay, I'm taking a risk here. I'm writing about somebody, you know, like, you know, taking somebody's eye out, you know, while chanting some verse, you know, and then trying to make sense of it. And then, and I'm not even there. I'm like, okay, now I have to wait for 3 days before I get to hear back with whether I'm fired.
Because this was all...
We had that you're fired email ready to go at any second.
I was like, I am so fired. It's been 3 days. I am so friggin' fired. And they just, they don't know how to word it. Just tell me. You know, I didn't know if I was fired, if they, you know, if they were like, you know, going to say, you know, oh, you know, nice initial attempt, try again. You know, I had no idea. A lot of times, I think. I was just doing my secretary thing and you know, waiting for my, you know, response or my next assignment or my next opportunity to go in and meet, you know, with the team. Does that make any sense?
No.
but I guess Terry, had you done like professional like writing before that, or?
Well, no, but because I had been in a band situation with Greg, he knew that I was like on my own, just like writing very strange short stories, and a lot of the times that I was in the band with him, we were all living in one band house. We called it the Tribe House. And so
that was the name of the band.
The band. And so we all lived in this house and we would watch movies together. So there was this whole like artistic, like, oh, you know, we're going to watch this movie and talk about it. Or so he knew, I think he knew that I would probably be into at least giving it a try to write, you know, screenplays for these cutscenes and stuff.
Because I know that, I mean, again, just I guess it's just fanboy stuff, but I think the writing in Thief is very good. And I've been to a lot of GDC screenwriting workshops where they're kind of like, hey, your game needs great writing. Now we're all getting into the Hollywood way of doing things. You need a character triangle, and your character needs to have three different attributes, right? That's a good character. And it's like, you got to be kidding. You know, And I'm not saying that you shouldn't like think and theorize and try to do a better job. And I'm not saying that people who teach creative writing don't know what they're doing. Just some of the ones I've seen at GDC, I have to say. but yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems quite good to me, as does a lot of the voice acting in the game. It doesn't have that kind of, you know, kind of Hollywood stamp of approval kind of feeling to it. And that doesn't mean to say it's bad. That means to say it's a little bit more loose and a little bit more real. And I don't know where I'm going with this other than to say that I think that it's, I just wonder if you had any thoughts on that. Like, did you feel like, oh no, I don't, you know, we need to like do a good job of this? Or like, did you have a sense of like what you're shooting for in terms of quality? I don't know if that's the right word. Or did you want it to be like movies? Or if you're thinking about stuff like, you know, Chinatown and the Third Man, that's a very different reference point for movies than a lot of the kind of screenwriting workshop kind of stuff you hear.
Right. Yeah. You know, I was trying to do the best that I could do with my limited experience doing it, but with a huge amount of enthusiasm and excitement trying to, you know,
I think coming from a non-game background is super important. I think that like, because Terry reads good books and sees good films, and I hate to generalize, but most of us nerds don't do that. Most of us nerds go, oh man, we should make that look like aliens again.
again.
And I think that's the thing that has always been missing from that was missing from video games then and continues to be missing from video games now, is that the sort of source material that you're steeped in, like on Thief, where, like, I mean, we like good trashy movies too, and, you know, like, I love Die Hard and I love Aliens and I love all that stuff, but, you know, because I think that, like, we were into, you know, crazier, more indie stuff, and that really affected what we were making up, and, like, it's hard to watch, you know, The Elephant Man, or, you know, any, like, you can't watch it, like, if you watch The Elephant Man, which is actually a huge reference point for, visually for Thief, by the way, I never get to talk about that, like, you can't go and draw a regular-looking, cruddy, medieval, you know, thing again. Like, you have a real, like, David Lynch is going to hugely influence that. Whereas, like, most people in games and in movies, like, they have the same source material all the time. Like, it's Aliens and it's Die Hard, and I wanted to make it look like the thing that I saw before. And now games have been around so long that people are raised in bad games. Like, there are so many, like, there are so few great works of art as games. And most people are in games. Most people that are in games are not into it for that kind of experience. And I think the games, like, they're great examples of, you know, they're finally starting to come out of, like, beautiful storytelling and artwork in games. But it's bizarre that it's taking this long to actually get that going. And I think that, like, with Thief, we had it so early on, you know, like the, you know, what Terry was writing, what we were coming up with was so much crazier and more indie than anything else out there, that it was just, everyone could like say that it was cool, but no one really knew how to latch onto it and repeat that. And so it was another 10 years before we saw it.
Maybe that's good though, right? Because that means that it wasn't cheapened by imitation, in a sense.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, well, I definitely feel like, and I don't mean to, because I think games today are completely amazing, but I feel like with movies, movies weren't around too long as an art form before someone started to make really serious movies, and people took them seriously as art. And games are just not there yet, and I'm not really sure why that's the case.
Well, maybe they're not watching The Third Man. A lot of them aren't.
And there's no games that are like, what's The Third Man of games, you know?
Right.
And like that's what games need. That's what game design and game storytelling.
You've got some great level design in The Third Man.
it's very true.
I think that the sewer would be a great last level.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. And that we would talk about that sewer. We would watch those clips. You know, when talking about like building certain areas in Thief. You know, because that was just the most amazing. Visuals, those sewers.
Yeah.
I have friends from Vienna, and after I saw that movie, I suddenly was like, "Oh my God, I want to go and visit your sewers."
Did they? Did you do that?
No, I haven't yet, but I want
to do that too.
I really want. They have. You know, they have a tour actually.
Do they?
Yeah,
oh my God.
Yeah, mentioning all this stuff is making me imagine like a 1940s version of Thief with like Joseph Cotten as Garrett.
Oh my God, that's my dream right there.
People talk a lot about awful female characters in games, and there's obviously a lot of them, but. You know, and I don't want to say it's just as bad for men, because I wouldn't quite say that, but it is true, though, that, like, I have absolutely no desire. Like, my idea of an awesome male role model is absolutely not most game characters, right? And Garrett's one of the few who was, like, actually really cool. And like, the kind of, you know, male character that... I might actually sort of want to be,
yeah.
and you know what I mean. It's definitely not a normal kind of hyper masculine cool character, and I'm wondering if Terry, if that was, did you want to write the character that way, or is that kind of in place like before you got there?
That was in place. You know, I think people had a really clear sense of who Garrett was supposed to be, and I think. Sometimes when I talk to Randy Smith, he'll still remind me that I wasn't the best at writing Garrett's voice, you know, like other people, because there were other writers like coming up with some of the, you know, mission, in between mission setups and stuff.
Like so, the narration when he's saying like, this is what I'm going to steal.
That's right. Yeah. You know, so I wasn't the only writer. And so Randy likes to remind me that, that I wasn't super great at writing, Garrett stuff. But I remember, you know, talking to different people about, you know, I think it was like the sharpshooter guy in The Untouchables. Is that right? Because he's so quiet, but so good at what he does. It was one of the character references. No, I can't remember them all. Do you remember some of the other ones?
I can't remember that character's name, but he's the guy in the Union Station shootout that's a ripoff of Battleship Potemkin.
Andy Garcia.
Andy Garcia, that's right.
Totally awesome, yeah. He's
and,
great.
And
he's, great
he's just like, you got him? And he's like, yeah, I got him.
Yeah, you know?
And, it's just, he was so, you know, he was just so few words, but just, you know, everything he said, you know, you want to just latch on to. And...
So Nobody and Thief was the accountant from The Untouchables?
No, there's a certain awesome professionalism about Garrett that I don't think you see in any other video game at all. Like, the focus of other characters in games is sort of to, you know, to kill as many people as possible, to look awesome while you're doing stuff and this kind of thing. Like, Garrett really just wants to be rich, take stuff and go home. Like, that's his whole goal. Like, he doesn't want to get involved with anybody, help the keepers, help him. Like, he's just like, I just want to break in, steal the vase, and go be rich. That's that.
That's so, right. I think he'd like to retire. I don't even think he really wants to steal, you know.
He doesn't want to do this at all. Yeah. Like, it's just the most, it's the only way that he can apply his talents.
But did both of you work on all three of the games or not the third one?
I worked on all three.
Okay, and the third one was at Ion Storm,
right?
And were you both on site for that, or was it kind of a long distance thing?
Long distance.
Okay.
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
The reason I ask that is because I had friends who played the first two games and didn't play the third one, and I finished the third one, and I remember really, really, really liking the ending, the way that it kind of resolves the Garrett character. And the way that I always kind of read the ending was that it's kind of like the kind of final irony of the character is that by trying so hard to stay out of everybody's way, the kind of final irony is that he's the only actual keeper, the end. And he kind of finally, it's like the keepers had sort of betrayed their own,
sort of rotted from within. I really wanted there to be an end to the Garrett story in the trilogy. And, you know, again, even just working part-time, I was like, they're never going to go for this, you know. But I really wanted his story to be done in case there was ever, if there was a Thief 4, I wanted it to be a different thief and have Garrett in a completely different role, you know, in the role of a keeper, in the role of someone who's been through all this and, you know, just wants to have everything be kept in balance and so the world doesn't, you know, fall apart. He's a hero, even though he never wanted to be a hero.
Yeah.
You know, so I wanted to...
That's sort of why he's a hero, right? Because he doesn't want to be. And it's like that power is only really... The only people who should have power are the people who don't want it.
That's right. And so he gets it.
So he gets it, you know? And he's like, God damn it. Right?
God damn.
Thief 2 ends on this, like, totally, like, really sharp cliffhanger. Was, at the time of Thief 2, was that kind of arc in the plan at that point, or was it kind of revised because of Thief 3? Because I know 3 sort of had to sort of assume that you didn't play the first two.
Yeah, well, I thought there was definitely Terry and I talked about this a lot, there was always an idea of the trilogy, and that it was sort of the first one was this the first bad guys are essentially, it's nature is the bad guy in the first one, and then the second one, it's science is the bad guy, and then moving on to misuse of knowledge in the first place is the bad guy in the third one, and Garrett is the balancing character between all three of them, and I remember that you had written up a document during Thief 2 that was a description of what happened in Thief 3, and as far as I can tell, it was like that's pretty much what went forward.
I have no recollection of that document.
Oh, man, no, I remember being really knocked out by it. I remember being knocked out by it.
Oh, really?
Because I think that you were the first one to sort of, recognize any sort of thematic structure to all to anything that we were doing, and so like the rest of us sort of started like just coming up with, you know, nonsense day to day, and Terry's the one who actually brought together, wait, we've been writing this for a while, maybe it's a story.
I think I eventually got some confidence. I think when I got confidence, like, you know what, I can actually pull off some ideas with this company, is when I wrote the line at the end of Thief One, the beware the dawn of the metal age line.
Oh yeah, and that was
that's the last line of the first game.
The last line of the first game, and I'm like, I am so setting up a specific kind of sequel. They are so going to push back on this, and nobody did.
Yeah, no, and in fact, that is the sequel. I mean, the sequel is that exactly, right? I mean, and it just like everybody was like, yeah, oh, I know exactly what this.
Yeah, cool.
Is
gonna
be.
All right, yeah. And I'm like,
because we read that, and like my first reaction to that was, I was psyched that we'd be able to do robots.
Yeah.
Awesome robots.
Awesome. Oh my god.
The Lynch connection is quite interesting. Is that more kind of in the the vibe and the feeling and of the cutscene specifically?
Well, yeah, especially Eraserhead and Elephant Man. Like those are giant.
Yeah, the black and white.
Yeah. Well, also just the setting is a really, and Elephant Man is a really steampunky setting. Like it's really like it's
it's,
you know, it's straight up Victorian, you know, machinery versus the human body theme, and it's really really intense, and very gritty and strange, and I think that probably pushed the visuals more than any other movie. You know, and because like story wise, I think there's you know, like Chinatown, there's another like Ken Levine, get him talking about Miller's Crossing. And that'll be an all day deal. Like, you know, love that movie. And I think that initially, even when we're in Dark Camelot days, like he really just wanted to see that Gabriel Byrne character in a medieval setting. Like,
that's well, that's funny too, that Dark Camelot, because Gabriel Byrne is in Excalibur.
Yeah, that's right, Liam Neeson, sure.
It's interesting that I'd never thought about Lynch. But now that you mention it, that's really interesting. And also interesting in the sense that Lynch is, in my opinion, one of the best horror directors I've ever seen.
I was saying that very same thing literally yesterday. That he, like, I want him to make a straight-up horror film because he makes some of the scariest things I've ever seen in my whole life. Like Inland Empire and stuff like this. Absolutely crazy, crazy films.
Well, and in the same sense, Thief is one of the best horror games I've ever played, even though it's not one. Right, it's sort of not presented as if it was one, but I think there's like that one level where you have to go back to the cathedral, and you actually and you go inside. I mean that was just, I mean, I had played.
Well, there's a tremendous feeling of dread that is woven into the entire setting all the time, and I think that that's an expression of both the story writing and the game design, because like the mechanism of the game design is, don't be seen. Like, be afraid. Be afraid of everything, because everything could probably kill you, and you have to hide in shadows and stuff like this. So I think that expresses itself outward through the story in that same way. It's just there's the two scariest scenes I've ever played are in Thief and in System Shock 2, when you're running from the psychic monkeys. I'd love to see more of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it seems to me that kind of, you know, it defies those kind of obvious labels, right? I mean, one of the reasons it's such great horror is because it doesn't sort of advertise itself that way. So the horror feels really unexpected and like it's really taking you by surprise. And I always, you know, it's one of those things I always thought like the best zombie game would just be Farmville. If it suddenly got taken over by zombies and players were like, what's happening? I got no idea. And the fact that Thief just kind of like is like, oh hey, it's medieval. Hey, you like wizards, right? Okay. And then it just hits you with like the most ghastly, horrifying stuff you can imagine. It's just totally awesome.
Oh, and there's like straight up like David Cronenberg body horror, like, you know, tearing your eye out and replacing it with a steel mechanism, like all sorts of like that. It's a weird game, man.
Oh, Cronenberg too. I feel like we could talk a lot more about Thief. But I did want to talk, I guess, a little bit, at least with Terry, about System Shock and some of the voice work.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, was that stuff that you did, like, did you like record it first? Did you like? I'm just wondering, like, what your direction was like for some of that stuff, or did you have a lot of context from the game when you recorded it, or was it like still the kind of over the fence kind
of
thing?
That was still over the fence. I wasn't working when I first recorded Shodan. I was just a contractor, and in fact, I don't even think that Looking Glass had a place to record. So I think I went over to Greg's apartment to just to record the first Shodan lines. You can double check with him that I wasn't in the studio. Later, you know, Looking Glass got their own little audio studio and everything. I think that my job with recording the lines was just to say them, you know, clearly and distinctly, without emotion, but with some up and down inflections. But then later, all the post-processing is what, you know, pulls the crazy out of Shodan. So.
Well, I know that one of the things that I think Eric said was that he thought you were trying to do something like the character was kind of like a young character or something, or like she didn't know. It's like she was sort of like Hal in 2001, where they're kind of like, they don't know a lot. They're kind of imitating a human being, right? But they don't know exactly, like, what do those voice inflections mean? Like, when Shodan sounds calm, does that she actually is calm? Or does that mean she just is sort of like, it's some weird approximation of some, like, artificial emotion or something?
A little bit childish, like going, you know, I won't be able to do it right now. But when adults are talking fluently, they go up at the right time with the tone and down at the right time with the tone. But when computers do it, you know, it takes a long time. So, or not at all. So when I was recording it, I would play with that a little bit in the you know, the initial recording. But I don't know if much of any of that survived the post processing. There's so much of it. You know, there's pitch shifting and there's, you know, I don't know, delays and all kinds of piecing together and, you know.
Yeah, Greg mentioned, although he said he wasn't thinking of this consciously at the time, he said in retrospect there may have been a Max Headroom kind of influence, right, with the stuttering and and the different ways that the post was applied and everything. So being a writer, though, you didn't write any of that dialogue ever?
I do not think I did. In fact, I think I remember being surprised by some of the lines. Like, really? Electrified torture bench? Really? I have to read that line? and Greg was like, yeah, you got to read it. And I'm like, all right.
That doesn't come up in regular conversation for you? I don't know why not.
This doesn't come trippingly off the tongue. But I will try it.
Oh, wow. Bizarrely enough, every time I try and write on my iPhone, that actually comes up, like, left and right when I'm trying to...
Electrified torture.
That would be,
be a really funny thing to slip into an autocomplete algorithm.
Electrified torture bench? No.
Google asks you, did you mean electrified torture bench?
And then the one time you do mean it, you can't get it to type it. That's the problem.
Speaking of voice acting, Dan, I understand that you did voice acting as well?
Yes, yeah.
Now, are you the, somebody said that you're the really dumb guard who I was saying I really liked how dumb they were.
Oh, I thought you were the mean,
or are you the mean
guard?
Or the smarter guard?
I am both the really dumb guard and the smarter guard. No, actually, the same dude who, because I played lots of dumb guards and I played one smart guard. The dumb guard that really made an impression, though, is played by the same guy who played Garrett. And he is hilarious.
You mean the Bear Pits guy, the guy who
Bear Pits guy,
the first thing you hear in the game,
yeah,
right? The first guy talking you hear in the game.
Yeah, I'm just sort of the irritated, you know, second banana in that scene. He steals the show.
But it sounds like you're the guy who's always reacting to the dumb guy, who the dumb guy says something, and you're the guy who's like, oh god, oh my god, no, it's not that. Oh please, don't. Oh my god, you know.
Because he's talking about some sort of wound that he has. I'm like, you really get that checked out? And he's like, no, the doctor said lots more leeches would be great, or whatever. It is. Yeah, really, really.
Yeah, I remember in Thief. I think was it Thief 3 that I wrote. Conversations specifically for you to respond to the dumb guard with. I think it was, I can't remember if it was like, if zombies bite, you know, if I promise if a zombie bites you, I'll cut off your leg. And you're like, no, that's only if he bites me in the leg. You're just, your delivery is so brilliant.
to be fair, the bulk of the audio recording that I did for that was grunting from being stabbed, which is like 80 pages of. I wish I were more famous for that because I'm really good at that.
actually, Eric said that you were really good at screaming.
Okay, so one of the best Dan Thrawn voice acting things, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, Dan, but it's in System Shock, and he's a doctor, and he's doing some sort of autopsy. And
in two or one?
It's in two. Yeah.
And basically it's like, you know, it starts just with some regular autopsy, you know, talk, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, hold him down, and then just goes into screaming, and Dan, it's just brilliant.
Yeah, that was an awesome bit of writing. I remember who put that together. That was like its own little radio show. It goes on for like 15 minutes too. It's so good.
Do you remember, were you a lot of voices in two, Dan? Or
I was only one or I only did one or two bits in two, I think.
I was
a voice in Terra Nova as well. That was the first thing I ever did.
Oh wow! But you weren't an actor in Terra Nova's.
Cutscenes. No, yeah, no. I was just one of the dudes that you hear when you're around.
I think I was the voice of the suit in Terra Nova.
Yeah, I think you were.
Oh, that's right. Wow! You're also the. This is slightly unrelated, but you're also the tutorial in. And Frequency.
Oh, right. Oh, my God, that's right.
And I mentioned that because when I was talking to Greg, I remember when I played Frequency the first time, I had this, like, weird freak out. Because it's like this, you know, it looks like cyberspace, right? And then there's this voice that sounds just like Shodan's voice, and it just made me feel that, like, man.
Things are going to go wrong fast.
Well, they did go wrong, because that game is so hard. It feels like it was designed by Shodan. And I say that as somebody who really likes the game. It's a great game, but it was just, I remember, but that's one of those funny kind of like looking glass harmonics, mm-hmm. almost kind of like crossover things, because a lot of the same people working on that stuff. But I did have one question for you, Dan. When I was, although this was not on the podcast with Eric, but when I spoke with Eric a little bit after the podcast, and he had mentioned I just want to confirm this. If it's not, that's fine. But there was a voice near the end of System Shock 2 that's like, I think his name is Prefontaine. He's like a,
yes.
Who is that? Is that you?
I think that's me. Yeah.
He's like a scientist who's like trapped in the many, and he's like,
yeah.
He's like totally horrified but totally fascinated at the same time.
Yeah. And because he's doing this sort of Joseph Conrad. Into the Heart of Darkness kind of storyline. It was really fun. I forgot about that one. That's good.
I just wanted to mention it because I have to say that that was like, again, it's just my opinion, but I thought that was like the most phenomenal bit of acting in the whole game. Like
the psychic monkeys. The psychic monkeys are great.
Well, the screeches are great. I have to say, but.
And I actually played, now that I forgot that I did this, but I'm also the voice of the mutants that try and club you to death. That apologize, the ones that are so sorry!
Those guys. Yeah. Those are really scary.
Those are super fun. Super fun. But yeah, no, I forgot all about Prefontaine. That was a great bit of writing.
Yeah. That was, I just remember, I think maybe just because, maybe it was because like Blair Witch was like sort of around that time. I remember thinking that was like, an entire Blair Witch movie, sort of as a radio show, in this one sort of self-contained scene, and I'm just having a fan moment, but it was just the
good job, Dan.
But the combination though of it's not that easy to act really scared and have it seem convincing, and there was something about the way
you haven't worked for Eric. That's obviously.
Maybe that would be great practice. Yeah, I'm sure. But it's great because you hear it a lot in games now. I mean, lots of games have taken the whole kind of like, oh, there's somebody coming up behind me, kind of a thing, right? So I mean, it's an easy device, and you hear it a lot. But some of them really stick out in memory, and that seemed like one. And you're, you weren't the guy who they paid, you know, all this Hollywood money to do that. You were just somebody who's there. You were just good.
Yeah. Really
Well,
good.
thanks very much. That's very kind of you. I appreciate it.
But
that's
but,
all I got.
No, Vince. No, but
no,
it's another example
you,
too of like when I you know I work with Sarah Varelli who was QA on System Shock, and I know that she worked on a lot of those games. And anytime she has to work with me, so she hears about how great her games are all the time, and. You know, she's always saying, you know, like, oh, but it was just the developers. Like, oh, it was kind of funny how the people who worked at the company were all the voice actors and stuff like that. And I mean, and there is a certain kind of, like, less professional feeling. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's also kind of pros and cons. Because if you really get that kind of, like, super expensive Hollywood sheen on everything, it kind of loses a certain level of reality to it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree.
And there's something indie about the voice direction and the voice acting in those games that I think is really good.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely one of my favorite parts of working on those games. It was all just, you know, we were just making stuff. It was such a cruddy little office, and we were all, you know, really, really good friends. And there wasn't a sense of, like now everything is so heavily... You know, over reviewed. Like, you know, like if you sit in dailies for visual effects shots, they'll like loop a shot 500 times, trying to find every last little thing wrong with it. Whereas like in like Looking Glass days, we'd be like, we would ship things and go, oh, that's messed up. Did anyone notice? Nobody noticed.
No, totally.
Yeah.
You know, and I think because we were only thinking about. What we thought was awesome at the time, then that's what comes across. Instead of worrying about whether or not we were doing a good enough job, we were just really enjoying doing the thing that we're doing.
Something that you guys were talking about earlier, just about, Dan, you were saying just being surrounded by so many incredibly smart people at Looking Glass. It really was a place where you just... I felt like I was, like, you know, everywhere I went, I was, like, just... talking to the smartest people I'd ever met, and making my way through that world. And I think that's probably why they didn't have a lot of... everybody was so smart and so capable and so motivated that they didn't need to have a lot of the systems that they set up now. And when I did start working full-time, there was no one there to teach you how to build levels or anything. There was no system for that. It was like, okay, now you're a designer. Build your level. It was sink or swim. And
they just gave you DromEd and were just like, there you go.
They were just, here's DromEd and here you go. And I would have sunk instead of swim if it weren't for Randy and Emil. And they were just like, you know, I would just... You know, I'm not afraid to ask questions and go, I have no friggin' idea what to do. But they were right there. And I think that, it was an exciting place to work. But, I mean, I could have been 2 weeks there and gone if it weren't for some certain key people there just, like, making sure that, you know, I didn't fail.
Yeah, right. Well, I think like that, even after we became like established at the company, you know, and everyone knew what we were doing and, you know, stuff like this, like it was people like, you know, like working with Mark Lazant, who knows 100 times more about art history than I do. Like the reason why the game is so rich and realistic in its and coherent in its design, art design, is because of Mark. Because like, you know, you have games today are... And I keep on, I know I sound like crotchety old dude when I say that, but like the bad games today are because people are, like, there's no narrative to the artwork, you know, like there's no coherent idea. There's just lots of showing off.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes things feel fake. It makes things feel like they lack history, you know. And between Mark Lazant, and I also want to give huge shout-outs to Jen Robota-Lesser, who is one of the greatest artists I've ever seen. Because of their knowledge of art and their practice of actual art in their private lives, like, they were interested in building things that were, like, that were deep and had a point as opposed to being a novelty. And like, I think, like, you know, if you ever could see Jen Robota's stuff, she's a traditional painter, and it's shocking and bold and rough and strange and all this stuff. And but because we the company kept on, instead of like trying to get more refined, I guess, and more corporate, like we kept on looking for people like the people that inspired us when we first worked there. That was when the company ended. That was the big sadness for me. I was like, you know, after that, I knew that I could get a better, like I could get, you know, a good job and get a better pay and stuff like this. But it was going to be, the next job was going to be the Blockbuster video of video games. Mm-hmm. This was a really, really unique place where people are creatively responsible to each other.
They were, I have a lot of fond memories of arriving in the morning after I'd leave at the night, my level would be broken. Just unopenable or just completely unplayable, and I had no idea. I'm not a technical person. And I'd leave, and I'd come back in the morning, and one of the programmers would go, "Hey, I fixed your level." I'm like, "Oh my God, thank you." It was amazing like that. Like they, people were really working hard to make it all work, and. It's really amazing.
Yeah, a lot of people. It's funny how, I mean, and it's not surprising if it's because it's obviously true. But every single person who's been on this podcast has said that. I mean, everybody is saying the same thing. They were just like, "Yeah, that was great." And he's not here right now. But Abe, the guy who usually monitors when we record these things, he doesn't really know much about the games. He didn't play a lot of them. But so he's a little bit more, he doesn't have the same context as a fan, but that's what he says to me after we record them. He's just like, "Oh my God, these people love this company. It was just like this like one of a kind of working environment that seems like it was really creatively well oiled and satisfying in that way.
I would agree with that. It was really wonderful, you know, working. I loved working with programmers and artists and other designers, and it was just this constant back and forth, and looking at the levels and you know, talking about what I wish I could have, and then, you know, 2 days later, you know, Jen or Matt or somebody would come up to me and say, "Hey, I made these for you." And I'm like, "Really? You did? Then I will put them in my level right away. I love them."
Like in terms of like what you do now am I right that like neither of you do games now?
You're not 100%.
I'm not 100% right, but not full time.
No, I'm not full time in games, but right now I'm, you know, currently long distance, still collaborating with Randy Smith,
For Tiger Style.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yep, and so even though I may never meet with that team, I'll still Skype with Randy and, you know, I was a little bit involved in Spider, but hopefully we'll be a little bit more involved in this game. But it's, you know, I'm a mom now and I've got 17 piano students and, you know, I'm trying to like volunteer at the school and stuff. And so I still love it and I'll do anything Randy, you know, if Randy calls me, it's and same with Dan. If like Dan said, "Terry, I need to help with this thing." Yes, whatever you need, ever, you know.
And it's really hard to maintain that kind of like AAA game company schedule, especially if you want to. It doesn't seem designed for people who want to have kids.
No, I don't think I could ever go back full time. Yeah. You know.
But people like Randy, I mean, I know that I know a lot of people who are just like, I want to do games, but I can't do it this way, right? I got to get out of here. I got to find some other way to do it. Looking Glass. But Dan, what about you?
I've been working in. My wife and I moved out to Los Angeles, and I've been working in movies for about six years or so. I'm mostly doing visual effects and concept art and storyboarding and matte painting and this kind of stuff. And making short films of my own and doing a lot of writing and all that kind of jazz.
Can I ask you what movies? Is it a secret or no?
No, no, no. I worked on a bunch. Let's see. I worked on. I did a bunch of the gore in David Fincher's movie Zodiac.
I love Zodiac.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I actually really liked Zodiac. I thought it was going to be 7-2, and it actually was not. It was its own totally different, interesting movie.
Yeah, no, that's one of my favorite films in a long time, and I was really psyched to work on that. And recently I worked on Tron, and what else? Thor for a little bit. Transformers 3, all sorts of stuff up and down the line.
Do you miss games, or is it what you're doing right now? Do you ever feel like you would go back, or is it really more like do you kind of like love film more?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's not so much I miss games. I feel like I really love great games, and so once in a while I get really obsessed with. Maybe one game a year, one or two games a year, and so I'm always interested in fresh new game design and seeing what's happening. But Terry knows that I'm the biggest movie nerd of all time, so I've been trying to get into that scene more than anything else.
Great. So, well, thank you very much, both of you. This was fantastic.
Yeah, right on, man. Thanks very much.